denomination in Israel. There will be no other nomination. I call on Mr. Jacob Barta to take the chair as acting chair for the day.
Good morning, members. I wish to welcome all of you to this meeting and immediately apologize for a late start. We're just about 35 minutes late. But I'm certain with everybody, cooperation will be able to complete the task for the day. The apologies that have been received, we have Ms. Fabs, who is the chairperson of the committee, and Ms. Kumalo, who are out of the country. The whip, Mr. Khadebe, is also out of the country. Ms. Kotze and Ms. Lebenya have also tendered their apologies. I hope those apologies are accepted, members. Any objections?
I move acceptance of the apologies.
Second. Yes. Moved by the Honorable Mabasa and seconded by the Honorable Jigalaga. Thank you. The first item on on the agenda. Oh yes, before that, let me welcome the officials from the department, particularly from the National Consumer Tribunal, Ms. Hazel, Dev Raj, the CEO, welcome. And Diane Terblanche, the chairperson, you're welcome. We will start with your presentation and I'll hand over to yourself to present your annual report to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members. It is indeed a pleasure to be here today to take you through our annual report. I would like to provide you with just a brief introduction in terms of the National Consumer Tribunal. The Tribunal did present to the Portfolio Committee during the induction process, but for the purposes of new members and also just to set the context, I'd like to take you through briefly in terms of the background. The National Consumer Tribunal was established in terms of the National Credit Act, number 34 of 2005. And in April 2011, we will be dealing with our extended mandate in terms of the consumer protection legislation. Now, in terms of fulfilling the purpose, the tribunal adjudicates in a fair and independent manner in terms of applications and rebuttals that come to it. With regard to the functions, depending on the type of matter that gets filed with the tribunal, the chairperson can allocate a matter to a one panel or a three panel member. In terms of Section 27, the tribunal or a member of the tribunal acting alone can adjudicate on an application that is brought before it and make an order provided for in the Act, or deal with matters of allegations of prohibited conduct and making a determination as to whether prohibited conduct has occurred or not, and if so, by imposing a remedy in terms of the National Credit Act. And as stated, from April 2011, we will be hearing and dealing with applications and rebuttals in terms of the Consumer Protection Administration. So the tribunal's mandate, as I said, is to hear and adjudicate on cases, and this also involves consumers, credit providers, your debt counselors, and credit bureaus. The tribunal also reviews the decisions made by the regulator. With regard to the structure of the organization, the NCT has been established in 2006. In September 2006, the president appointed 16 independent non-executive tribunal members. Ms. Angel Blanche was appointed as the chairperson, as well as the executive chairperson of the tribunal. As I go through my presentation, I will also address some of the questions that we received. And one of them related to why is the status of the chairperson that of executive chairperson? In response to that, when the National Consumer Tribunal was established, there was a business case established in the tribunal, and that business case was submitted by the Department of Trade and Industry. According to the business case, there wasn't a board that was going to be elected, but a chairperson who will fulfill an adjudicative function as well as that of executive chair, and also becoming then the accounting authority for the organization. So the chairperson then has a dual role in that of managing the adjudicative function, allocating cases, as well as performing the functions of executive and accounting authority, executive chairperson and functions of the accounting authority. Now, the chairperson is therefore, in terms of the structure, responsible for the governance and oversees the operation. Now, the structure of the organization, and I'll deal with that in a bit of detail just to give you some of the context, is that it hasn't been adequate to fulfill many of the functions that the tribunal needs to deal with. You'll see that the chairperson fulfills the role of as chair and the accounting authority. Then we have a CEO registrar. There's a slash there to that position, which is fulfilled by myself. And also one of the questions was, what is the exact title, CEO versus registrar? Now, just to explain, as CEO, I become responsible for the implementation of the business plan, for offering directions in terms of the operations and supporting the adjudicative function. The position of registrar deals specifically with cases that come through to the tribunal, ensuring that cases are correctly filed with the tribunal, and moving the cases through to finalization. And once again, offering that support to the adjudicative function. In terms of the PSMA, the NCT is also required to have a CFO. I fulfill the role of CFO in the organization. So the structure has been very lean. Under corporate services, for example, there was only one position that was created. And that requires of one person to fulfill your HR functions, your finance functions, IT, and administration. This creates problems in terms of segregation of duties as well. And it is not possible for one person to fulfill all those functions. What we then did is created a finance consultant position that gets outsourced to deal with all the financial aspects and to ensure that we have adequate segregation of duties within the organization. We have also created a contract post under communication. As a new organization, it is imperative for us to go out to our stakeholders and actually indicate what is the role and function of the tribunal. So the profiling of the organization is a critical aspect, and therefore we have the position of a communication specialist. As indicated, the tribunal does not have a board, so the chairperson fulfills the position of accounting authority, and the minister is of trade and industry is the executive authority. Now, the chairperson is assisted by the Audit and Risk Committee, who provides the governance oversight and gives advice to the chairperson in terms of governance issues. And then there's the chairperson's advisory committee. And the advisory committee provides strategic input and advice to the chairperson. The chairperson's advisory committee consists of the chairperson, the deputy chairperson of the competition tribunal, Professor Bonke Dumisa, of the National Consumer Tribunal, and Advocate Fatima Lonela, who is one of the tribunal members. So those members form part of the chairperson's advisory committee. And it's really to assist the chairperson in strategic issues or issues that she may want further clarity on from members. So that is in terms then of the governance structure of the NCT. During the reporting period, strategically it was important for the tribunal to align itself to the strategic objective of the Department of Trade and Industry and to assure that alignment of how we align ourselves with the department and obviously contribute to their broader strategic objective. In looking at the DTI's strategic objectives, the one strategic goal that came out quite prominently was to promote broader participation, equity, and redress in the economy. So the six goals, strategic goals, that the National Consumer Tribunal have been aligned then to that strategic goal of the Department of Trade and Industry. I want to just take you through broadly in terms of offering broader participation in the economy. And this is really relates to the adjudication and the decisions that come out of matters before the tribunal. So the NCT would contribute by freeing up or increasing funding in the economy, for example, when it adjudicates on prohibited conduct, in cases whereby people have been overcharged in terms of interest rates or they've been overpayments in terms of what they should have been paying. And that's in terms of the National Credit Act. We also see this role when we start dealing with the consumer protection legislation, the impact that the decisions and the outcomes would have on the economy is that we would deal with prohibited conduct issues as, for example, ensuring that people get value for money, that there is quality and safety of goods and services. And that relates then when we start dealing with the consumer protection legislation. Furthermore, the National Credit Act, we could also look at availing and increasing funding through adjudicating on cases of prohibited conduct. For example, when we look at assessment criteria for how credit has been advanced, that will also ensure greater equity in the market. The important question and something that will be in your mind is, what has the tribunal done to help people operate? Now, as a tribunal, we are dependent on cases coming and being filed with us. We get cases from the National Credit Regulator. We get cases from your credit providers, from your debt counselors. So, yes, as far as we can go and indicate this is our role, this is our function in terms of matters that can be brought to us, we are really dependent on the types of matters that get filed with us. And decisions will be made on matters that are adjudicated on. So what have we been able to do with the cases that have been before the tribunal? This indicates or talks then to providing redress. The entity contributes to providing redress. It has dealt specifically with matters around the review of sale of goods. Sorry, I just missed the slide here. We've had applicants coming to us to say that their vehicles haven't been sold at the best price reasonably possible or as soon as reasonably possible. And we've dealt with cases of deregistrations where the regulator has brought cases before us for an order to deregister credit providers and debt counters. Specifically under the review of sale of goods matters, there have been two significant cases. One case that was dealt with in this financial year, which is the Mapeka versus West Bank case. And what the tribunal actually found is that the parties had not followed the correct procedures in the termination of the contract, and that the process was irregular. Now, the applicants, then outside of the tribunal process, once this judgment was issued, managed to get a favorable settlement with the respondent. And the debt of $61,955 that needed to be paid was then settled. In 2008-2009, we had another matter dealing with the review of sale of goods in the Dumas versus the Motor Finance Corporation. And there also the parties reached a settlement where the consumer was credited for the outstanding balance of $43,000. What has happened through the review of sale and what we've seen is that once a decision was made in this matter, the first decision or judgment was issued in the Dumas matter, we have a second case that was filed with the tribunal. And in that, it was also against the same respondent. But we found that the parties withdrew the matter, and they then settled outside of the tribunal. And here, the consumer was credited to the value of $90,000. So that's dealing specifically with the review of sale matters that have come before us. In instances where we had deregistration of debt counselors and credit providers, it was really to ensure then that vulnerable consumers are protected against the unscrupulous registrants. We've had two debt counselors where an order was made to deregister them, and two debt counselors and one credit provider was given the opportunity to go back and to review their processes and revise their processes accordingly. There was also a deregistration of Fabric Trading as Cashwise. This was a credit provider that was deregistered. That was an order by the tribunal. During the reporting period 2009-2010, the chairperson and myself had a session where we spoke to consumers in Upington. We were invited to Upington to speak to consumers during a consumer rights day. And you know what was very interesting and touching was that we could see firsthand and experience firsthand the impact that the decision of the tribunal made on the lives of people. In Uppington, these consumers were being exposed to this credit provider, Cashwise, who was keeping their identity documents because they are taking loans from the credit provider. They were keeping their bank cards, their PINs, they were taking insurance policies as collateral for loans that had been taken out. And these people explained how their lives were impacted by the unscrupulous behavior of a credit provider. So I wanted just to explain and share that experience with you because, as I said, it was an opportunity for us to see how an order really impacted on people's lives. Furthermore, in terms of providing redress, the tribunal has received an increase of 11,250% with regard to consent order applications received during this financial period. Now, by confirming a consent order, what happens is that the parties are given certainty that they will be repaid the debt that is owed, and consumers are able to ensure that they restructure their debt so that they are able to make these repayments. And it protects them from losing their vehicles or their houses or those, you know, the assets that they have. Now, once the debt is paid off, it will allow the consumer then to re-enter the economy and contribute towards economic growth. So this is really about providing the stabilization and certainty for all players by confirming consent order applications. Now, this is not such an easy process. Yes, we received a high volume of consent order applications, but when tribunal members consider them, it not about just confirming the orders. They take into account, have the interest rates that are being charged, are they legal? Are consumers paying amounts that they should be paying? Are they not being overcharged in terms of what their total repayment should be? So what you'd find is that there have been judgments where consent orders haven't been confirmed, because it is really about ensuring that parties are protected in this process and that the consent order is legal at the end of the day. I'd like to take you through the high-level performance results in terms of how we've achieved in our annual report, the details of which you will find under the performance information in our annual report. So I'm going to touch high level and talk on the strategic issues. On the strategic goal number one, the tribunal wanted to profile the tribunal as an accessible adjudicator of consumer and credit matters. Strategically, our key performance indicator was to increase the cases filed with the tribunal by 10%. During our first year of operation, 2007-2008, we had received 11 cases. During 2008-2009, we received 26 cases. We were targeting at least a 10% increase on the cases that we had received. What ultimately did happen at the end of the financial year is our cases filed increased by 1,776%. So we had a huge increase in the number of cases. So from 11 cases to 26 to 488 cases filed with us. In terms of the business plan, what we set was initiatives to contribute to achieving that strategic goal. So some of the highlights in terms of what we did achieve was we had 7 introductory sessions where we went to the provinces. And we did this initiative together with the consumer affairs offices. The tribunal has a very specific role to play, and therefore it's not there to educate consumers on their rights and in terms of the legislation. That function is performed by the actual regulators. But as an adjudicative body, we are there to say, this is our role, and this is how you can come to us for matters that you want to file with the tribunal. So we do it in conjunction with the consumer affairs officers. We have 7 sessions in KwaZulu-Natal, the Western Cape, Limpopo, Free State, Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, and Mpumalanga. Then we had 7 circuit court hearings. 5 were held in Suriname. The reason being is that we received the bulk of our consent order applications work on Suriname. So we heard the matters in Suriname. 1 matter was heard in Harrismith and 1 in Johannesburg. The purpose of having these circuit court hearings was to ensure that the tribunal is more accessible. We're based in Pretoria, and we get applications from people in different areas. It was to make ourselves more accessible and also then to go out to where the parties were so that we could also expose our role and functions in terms of what we do. Still on the same strategic goal, we published 82 notices of complete filings and the 9 reasons decisions were published on the website. The reason we published the notice of complete filings is to inform parties that this is the case before the tribunal, and should they wish to intervene in a matter, they can apply to intervene. And really exposing our judgments so that people are aware of what have been the outcome of matters before the tribunal. We developed the NCT video, which we distributed during the sessions we had, and we've also placed it on the website. We had 8 information pieces developed specifically around how can we as a tribunal help you, the consumer, when can you come to us? How can we help you if you are a registrant, that is a debt counselor or a credit bureau or credit provider? And we spelled out what is our role and how do you come to the tribunal for assistance. Those information pieces were put out on the Consumer Affairs magazine. They were distributed to all the registrants on the on the National Credit Regulators database. We also had direct interactions with vulnerable consumers through 3 rural events and 1 urban event. And we sent out an email shot to all the registrants, again explaining what is our role and what is our function. strategic goal number two, this was to contribute to the development of a rights culture. What we wanted to achieve strategically was to be able to look at policy inputs that we could make to the Department of Trade and Industry, looking at efficiencies, looking at things that could be changed in the legislation or in our rules. And we also tied it very closely to the cases that we received and where we found that things could be dealt with more expeditiously, for example. And ensuring that we have a 5% increase in the matters filed based on those information pieces that we distributed. So the output, the performance output, is that policy inputs or the amendments to the rules were discussed with the Department of Trade and Industry, and those rules will now be revised once we look into the consumer protection legislation, so that there will be a consolidated set of rules that will then be revised and published. I indicated the caseload and the increase in the caseload. Some of the targets we set out in the business plan to achieve the strategic objective dealt with the reasons decisions and orders were distributed on our cases. And we also did research on the case in terms of the efficacy of the Act, and then what are the procedural and substantive issues that come out of the cases that were filed with the tribunal. And here around the amendments to the rules, what we found is issues of accessibility. For example, there is a fee, it is a minimal fee, but people have to pay a fee to file an application with the tribunal. And our view was that, you know, it takes a bigger administrative burden to monitor the fee and manage that fee. Although there is a process to have that fee waived, the chairperson can waiver that fee, but it may not be necessary at the end of the day. So that is one of the issues we looked at. And then around proof of service, the rules require, in terms of proof of service, that it has to be by registered mail, for example. And Parson said, you know, with the huge number of consent order applications that have been coming to the tribunal, it's very costly for debt counselors to now send proof of service to all the different credit providers. And they wanted an opportunity to have the documents back through. So in terms of accessibility and from a cost perspective, that would be one of the amendments we could look at in the rules. And also just having the form simplified so that people know this is what we need to complete and this is how we need to approach the tribunal. On the substantive issues, this related more around the referrals from an ombudsman to the tribunal. So for example, if the banking ombudsman deals with a matter and they've had a ruling on it, they can't bring that matter directly to the tribunal. They would still have to go via the National Credit Regulator on that matter. So this was just something in terms of the amendments to the legislation, one of the substantive issues that was raised. Strategic goal number three is ensuring a consistent and coherent application of the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act. In terms of the Act, the National Consumer Tribunal has concurrent jurisdiction on matters with the provinces as well. So there's been constant engagement with the provincial offices and the building of capacity around how do matters get handled in terms of the National Credit Act. And to engage with the provincial offices to find out, to share ideas with them, to hear from them as well, what ideas they can share with us, to ensure that we do have a consistent regulatory approach in matters that are filed, be it with the National Consumer Tribunal or in a province. So that whether a party goes to the province or they come to the tribunal, that they offer redress and they face the similar process and procedure and this consistency. So we had six joint education programs with the different consumer affairs offices, and was really about discussing how do we adjudicate on processes, on cases, what are the processes, what are the decisions that have been reached. And once again, as I said, it's really to ensure that we have concurrent jurisdiction. Strategic goal number four is positioning the tribunal as an authoritative adjudicator of consumer and credit matters. And our strategic KPI was to say that 2% of decisions could be overturned on review or appeal. Being a new entity as well as decisions come out, it is a learning curve for everybody. So we said 2% would be something that would be acceptable. We've had 0% of the decisions overturned on review or appeal. One matter was taken on appeal, but it was later withdrawn. And how do actually, what are some of the business plan objectives that we've actually put in place to ensure that then when tribunal members reach decisions, that they have all the information available to them, and what is that support given to ensure that there's reasoned and good decisions at the end of the day. So there are 40 workshops that are held, capacity building workshops that are held with tribunal members. We also invite the provincial officers to join us. And we share experience. We have experts to come and talk around areas of law, what's happening in the economy. We discuss key issues of finalized cases. We discuss different sections of the Act. We look at adjudication and what does it mean in terms of the National Credit Act to be expeditious, to be inquisitorial during a hearing. So all these key aspects get discussed and people engage on these areas. There was also exposure to international standards where we went to Australia and New Zealand to look at the tribunals there and the way they adjudicate on matters. What we did find interesting that being a new entity, we are really quite advanced in terms of the adjudicating process and the support that we offer tribunal members. For example, we've got a case management unit that does research and analyzes cases which they provide information to tribunal members when they go through their papers. What we also found was that the tribunals in Australia and New Zealand, they deal with various pieces of legislation. So it's one tribunal that is under the Department of Justice. They report to the Department of Justice, and they deal with different pieces of legislation. So in a day, they deal with matters on motor cars, on payments, on consumer issues, and they deal with a lot of small claim issues. And the way they structure their processes is that they look at areas of specialization. So they will have tribunal members that sit and only hear matters relating to motor car defects, for example. And their support is to have assessors. So they'd have almost like an expert in that field who would help them and be an assessor and provide guidance to them during the hearing process. So those are some of the interesting things that we've picked up and the differences in terms of the way they adjudicate on matters and the way we would adjudicate on matters at the tribunal. There were 9 reference papers that were developed, and this was really around then key issues that came out of cases that we then share with tribunal members in terms of enhancing and building capacity. Strategic goal number 5 dealt with the resource in the tribunal to fulfill its mandate. We were looking strategically at getting our funds increased. And during the MTF process, we put in a submission and we did get additional funding for this financial year. We had discussions with DTI on this. And we also just did a benchmark report on what are the resource requirements of similar institutions. As explained, our structure is inadequate, and we really need to ensure that we have a broader structure to fulfill the mandate. Strategic goal number 6 deals with the adjudicating on matters before the tribunal to fulfill its mandate. And we wanted to ensure that 100% of our cases were adjudicated on. In terms of the legislation, we are required to be expeditious. So in the terms of the timelines we set, we said, we want to ensure that cases where they have been complete and there's been close of pleading and where they're ready for a hearing, that matters will be set down if it was a consent order application or an interim relief within 2 weeks of close of pleading, and if it was another matter, within 4 weeks of close of pleading. So those are some of the measures we put in place to ensure that when cases come to us, we take them through a process and that ultimately they get adjudicated on. And we don't want a backlog of cases with the tribunal. So those are the targets we set in terms of the business plan. And you'll see the business plan and the performance information was very detailed in terms of what we wanted to achieve. I've explained in terms of this strategic goal, just the increase. And you'll see, as I said, the previous financial year, there was a great increase in the number of cases filed with us. What this has meant is through the adjudication that decisions were reached and the tribunal was able to ensure that precedent is set. We dealt with deregistrations and there were judgments in that regard. The tribunal also dealt with an application to demand the delivery of a statement, but the decision was that it was the right of a consumer and not a company in terms of the legislation. Then on consent orders, as indicated before, tribunal members really looked at whether interest rates are legal, whether people are paying the amounts that they should be paying, and can they really afford to repay their debt. So not all consent orders were confirmed. There has been a judgment, which we've provided details of in the annual report on this matter. We've dealt with DV of sale of goods, and we also dealt with the case where there was failed alternate dispute resolution, and the matter was filed with the tribunal. However, the tribunal found that they didn't have jurisdiction to deal with the matter. That then sets the context in terms of what were those strategic goals we wanted to achieve, how we have achieved those strategic goals, and I also provided then input in terms of the business plan objectives and the performance information in terms of what we have achieved. I want to go on now and talk around the challenges that we face as a tribunal and our achievements. And you know, when I talk challenges, it's really about saying, yes, as a tribunal, we have challenges and we recognize them. But we also say, what are we doing about it? What are we doing to ensure that we address those challenges and we move on as an organization? And that has been critical for us. The first challenge has been around the inadequate organizational structure. And we have put forward a proposed structure to the Department of Trade and Industry. We've created some positions on a contract basis. And those discussions, as I've indicated, are still proceeding. We've had a high level of staff turnover. We had two senior managers who are on leave of absence. One was myself. I was on maternity leave last year. And one of our senior managers was on sick leave. That was a challenge in the organization. Being a small organization with a staff complement of 9 people, when one person is not there, the gap is felt in the organization because people have to fulfill more than one role. For example, we would have a registry manager, and that person deals with registry. They deal with facilities. So with a small complement, people have to double up on their roles and what they need to achieve. So, yes, the organization has been faced with a high level of turnover. But as a National Consumer Tribunal, and I'll take you through as I discuss also, you know, when we talk around performance in the organization, is that we've applied performance criteria very strictly. And you will see by the manner in which we reported in our annual report, we've either said we achieved or we didn't achieve. And a lot of the deliverables call for 100% deliverables. Now, that we've aligned to staff member performance contracts, and we've taken the stance that we do hold people accountable. We're there to perform at the end of the day, and we need to be able to show that performance, and what are we doing as an organization. So those factors, yes, have impacted. And what we've done is we've looked at what is an HR strategy and plan to ensure that we bring the right people on board. We do follow a proper recruitment process and a thorough recruitment process. We do proper reference checks, and to ensure that we also have a good organizational fit with the people we bring into the organization. To have a proper induction process so that people understand what we want to achieve as an organization, what are the values of the organization, and what is required then of them at the end of the day. So we've put together an HR strategy and plan, and we're in the process of implementing that plan. From an IT perspective, we've had numerous problems with our IT infrastructure and our downtime. Now, remember, this has been a new organization that had to be established. So even setting up the IT systems, all that had to be done internally. To deal with those issues, we put together an ICT strategy and a plan to guide us and to ensure that we eradicate these challenges. The tribunal members have been appointed in 2006. They haven't received an adjustment in terms of their remuneration or cost of living increase from 2006. The NCT has had discussions with the DTI, and those discussions are still carrying on. Then, the next challenge is the number of tribunal members. In order to be legally constituted, there needs to be 10 members and a chairperson. There have been tribunal members who have resigned, so additional members need to be appointed in order for the tribunal to be legally constituted. as this will pose a risk to the organization, and we need additional members to fulfill functions also once we get the consumer protection legislation to deal with. And even on that, DPI is engaging with us, and we're having discussions on how to meet that challenge. We haven't received referrals from the National Credit Regulator in the previous financial year. That was also one of the questions asked in terms of how many referrals we received. We haven't received any. And this is something we have recognized as a challenge because it does impact on the entity's ability to set precedent. And as I indicated before, we actually need to wait for cases to come to us and to be filed with us. So cases coming from the regulator, what we've done, steps taken then is to have interactions with the regulator around this. And we will take it further. I mean, we will engage with them further on it. We start the process, and we will look at further engagement. Achievements. 85% of the business plan activities were met. There were 62 activities. So, yes, there was quite a bit of activities that we needed to achieve. 85% were achieved. We also had a service charter conference, where we got together with our stakeholders to find out what are their expectations of the tribunal? What has been their experience? And how can, as a tribunal, can we work better to ensure that we offer greater service to the people that approach us? And also saying, what is your responsibility if you come to us to file an application? Because it's a two-way process. And ultimately, we all need to work together to get to a decision on a matter. So that was quite an interesting session, to lay out what are the expectations and then ultimately what does the tribunal need to deliver on to ensure that we deliver to our stakeholders and to their satisfaction. We've obtained an unqualified audit opinion from inception, that's 3 years now. There's been a great deal of emphasis in the organization on good corporate governance to ensure that we have policies, procedures and systems in place. So a lot of effort has gone into ensuring we have the necessary systems that people comply with policy requirements and legislative requirements. Judgments, the judgments that have been made have created greater certainty for parties, and we've also been able to set precedent. I touched on the issue of circuit court hearings, where we've had circuit court hearings to really ensure that we can become more accessible as well. And the interactive sessions with the provincial officers to ensure that we have a more consistent regulatory framework is another highlight of the tribunal. On the financial performance, our total revenue was 17 million for the previous financial year. We had a surplus that we brought forward of 2.6 million, and our total expenditure was 18 million. Million. We did have a surplus at the end of the financial year, and I'll take you through the details of that surplus and the reasons for that. Overall, the budget has been well managed. We've had no irregular and wasteful expenditure. If you look at our previous annual reports, there were minor instances of irregular and wasteful expenditure on a telephone account and the workman's compensation. That was for 2008-2009. And we've made sure that in 2009-2010 that those problems have been eradicated and we've had no instances of irregular and wasteful expenditure. On the surplus, we have submitted a submission for the adjustment of the tribunal members' fees. We were still waiting for that approval. Then there were two projects that were not finalized, and this related to economic research and the website development. And during our provincial sessions, we had budgeted for a higher amount of people attending. So the budgeted amount was higher than what was actually spent. Then you will see from our financials that there have been significant changes in the expenditure trends. And I want to touch on what those changes are and why they occurred. Staffing costs. During that period, we had more staff appointed than the previous year. And we also brought in additional people to assist us with some of the key projects that we needed to finalize and to deal with those HR matters that we identified which were key risks to the organization. Our consultant cost, we've got a limited structure. So, for example, the finance consultant, that is a cost that comes under this budget. We also have cleaning services. We need a receptionist who is on a temporary basis because that position isn't on the establishment. We do use consultants to facilitate our strategic planning, business planning, risk management. And what was really critical for us this year, or the previous year, was to look at the development of the disaster recovery and business continuity and ensure that we could test that with the organization. I touched on the outsource functions that have increased, this line item and the spend expenditure there. The other items where there was expenditure on that line item related to the publishing of the annual report, our payroll service is also outsourced, and all this contributed then to that final figure. Travel and subsistence, there were more hearings due to the increase in the number of cases. Remember, we've got tribunal members in different provinces, and we bring them to Centurion to have matters considered. We did an international benchmarking during that financial period, and we had a lot of provincial interactions, which required traveling. Compliance costs, the scope of our audits due to the risk that was facing the organization that had an impact. We've had the involvement of our audit and risk committee members who assist us with the audit function and the risk function, and they also fulfill functions in terms of fraud prevention, where staff or any stakeholder can contact them should there be reports of fraud and corruption. The organization is too small to have somebody internally deal with something as sensitive as this. So the committee plays a role as well. And being a small organization, the PFMA requirements are still the same. So whether we are 9 staff members or 120, we still have to ensure compliance with PFMA and the necessary regulations, which does create a compliance burden for a small organization. I would like to touch on the 2010 audit report from the Auditor General, and I must say there have been valuable lessons learned from the performance information audit. This was the first year that audit was done regarding performance information. And the findings we had related to that our indicators were not accurate compared to the source information, and performance information systems were not appropriate. And I'd like to touch on that and just explain further. The NCT developed, implemented, and started with a rigorous process of collecting and verifying performance information from as early as 2008-2009. So we started very early on that process to ensure that we have the systems in place, that we collect the information, and we've been very strict. You will see in our business plan we have 62 activities that we needed to report on. And we applied the criteria that we either achieved or we didn't achieve. So if we said we needed 100% and 99% was done, we said not achieved. And for every output that we were supposed to achieve, we had to have source of information, which was provided and available. Now, what we learned and the lesson we've learned through this audit is that being a legal entity, we use certain terminology. So, for example, one of our strategic or measurable objectives was that we would adjudicate 100% of cases where matters are complete, stroke, closed, or there's been close of pleading. And there was an issue around terminology, because how do we know now whether a matter is complete or it's been closed off pleadings? And this is where there was inconsistency with the way we viewed and interpreted terminology and the way it was interpreted during an audit. So that's been a valuable lesson. And what we take from that is that as a legal entity then, and when we put forward our business plan, our strategic plan, that we define what we mean by the terminology that we use. So when anybody from the outside then wants to come and test the information, that we all have a common understanding. So what we're doing now going forward is to ensure that our key performance indicators are well defined. As I said, that we have a common understanding. And another critical aspect is that if you look at our business plan, as I said, we've had 62 activities. As a small organization, our business plan almost became an operational plan. What we need to ensure is that we have fewer objectives, but they're more high level, because strategically that is what the Auditor General will look at, and we report against those strategic high level objectives, and that's the performance information that we will collect. In conclusion, I'd like to say that As the National Consumer Tribunal, we look forward to the implementation of the consumer protection legislation from April 2011, and this will really then extend our mandate. Yes, there will be challenges in terms of it being a new legislation, and there will be issues around interpretation of the legislation, but we're confident that as we've taken up a new piece of legislation and established the National Consumer Tribunal from inception, that we will also make this a success in terms of the consumer protection legislation and what we need to achieve. So we are hard at work at ensuring that we get the appropriate funding and structures in place to deal with the challenges and to deal with our extended mandate. And I wish to thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Blanche, the chairperson. Would you want to add anything?
No, thank you, Chair. But if there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to respond.
Members, let's deal with the issues now. Honorable Mabasa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair, and thanks for the input. My first question is assuming that we just randomly visited an informal settlement or a rural area, or a typical township, do you get the impression that the people there will be aware of your existence and that they are utilizing your services? That's one question. And then the next one is, what is the procedure of bringing a case yourselves, especially for poor people? And that fee that you spoke of opening a case for the management, how much is it? But then, assuming that you win a case, but when you win the case, you realize that the case that you have won could benefit many other people who have suffered the same problem as the one that has been brought to you. Do you have a way of transferring the benefit of that victory to the broad people that find it very difficult to access most of these financial institutions? And then redress. Do you have a way of instituting redress against unscrupulous service providers? By the language, how many languages are you utilizing? Because that also counts on access. And what is the relationship between you and the ombudsman as well as the court? So that the three bodies, how do they relate, and where are we going to put in the Act as a fourth body, and how will you relate to the Consumer Act after April next year? But assuming that a case is handled now, can the benefits of April 2011 be retrospectively, can they retrospectively benefit a case that was lost or won now? Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mulata. Honorable Usman.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to add something to the previous speaker. Actually, how will the Consumer Act actually have the impact on cases before the implementation of that actual act, so outstanding or those cases? In your organogram, it wasn't clear to me how your provincial offices or your other areas of offices, because as I understood that you've got other offices, and I couldn't see the linkage of how that one fits in. Looking at your business plan and trying to understand the smart principles of your actual output concerning the skills development, and also taking your message out there in the seven hearings or court hearings or those places that you went to, the actual impact that you had, I don't know how many people you trained, percentage-wise, how many people did you went to go and see, you know, what was that actual ability on that? The other thing that also concerns me is I do understand that you've got a problem concerning your HR shortages, your human resource shortages, and especially on the financial side, therefore your consulting fees. And looking at your consulting fees that you got, was the proposal ever to say that let's reduce the consulting fees by R1 million and appoint two people or whatever the case is in order to give that right, because I know what those people are working per hour and per rate, and obviously it will be much cheaper to employ those one or two positions, especially in those things. Maybe I'll just read we were talking about costs. There were two things that was outstanding projects. Are they still continuing, or have they are they abstract by costs? I just needed a bit of clarification on that one. Maybe on a second round, I'll go around maybe.
The Honorable Jigalana.
Thank you, sir. I must, first of all, express appreciation of this telling work that has been done by the tribunal from the date that we established it in the last term. It seems a lot of effort has been put into ensuring that it shapes up, but in now that its mandate is going to be extended. Having said that, Chair, I have a couple of questions. The first one I have is when I look at some of the things that have been raised and also some exposure through the report, there has been an exponential growth of workload. But then what comes in mind is that has there been any research or survey done to estimate this expected load of work? Secondly, in terms of case statistics, if I'm correct, seems about 250 cases have been incomplete or are incomplete in 2009-10 year as compared to 204 cases completed. It might be helpful that we just have an explanation how that happens, because I take the point that the NCT is not keen to have backlogs. Let's come to National Awareness Campaign. You know, Chair, the reference was made to the Upington breakthrough. I don't even call it just a case. It's a breakthrough. But then the question I have, which links to the survey that I was asking, I asked about as well, why not handle a national awareness campaign jointly with the NCR specifically, because of the, I assume, first level bodies and DTI generally, probably also was even thinking of your bank and insurance ombudsman and stuff, because one tries to understand the nature and character of the tribunal. It's not a frontline service provider within government or a frontline agent like the NCR. So one wouldn't expect that you would go gun blazing like NCR or CEDA or any other agent. But still, people need to know about it. If you could do such a breakthrough as you have done in Upington, and even one could even go further and say, look, have you worked out any arrangement with SABC, you know, as a whole, up to the National Community Radio Forum? As you can see, my question is loaded, Chair, but we need to get comments on that, because those are indigenous of mass media, you know, such that we people are aware of this. This links to my second question. Well, the first one was that I was about to say the campaign the same throughout South Africa. Then I realized that Ms. Devrach has actually made reference of three activities in one in rural areas, but still I will begin to understand that. Do you handle rural areas in the same way as you handle urban areas? Because Chair, website, video, and emails are mentioned. Now, where I was born, I would still come to thin my hand or two hands. A number of websites, maybe videos. So it would be helpful, you know, to just to share with us as how they see that. Chair, a lot of reference has been made to the human resource constraint and the intention to resolve this constraint as well as the employee turnover, which I tend to believe. But still, what I seem to be missing is what is the ideal staff complement? Just the ideal, because obviously we all have the ideal and work towards fulfilling it. Ms. Honorable Smaller made reference to provincial offices. I was keen on that. I'm just re-emphasizing it. How would I see a difference between a national, an office of the national or the national tribunal as compared to an office of a provincial tribunal? And what would be a distinction between them? Maybe I'm approaching the same question, you know, from a different angle. And another heavy one, unfortunately. At the end of the day, how does Parliament have a real national picture? You know, Chair, if you could allow me, I'll give you an example. I'm sure quite a number of us were in Atlanta when we had a report from the unit that deals with cooperatives within DTI. And for the first time, Chair, that day, it was September last year, when we were able to have a national, true national picture of what is done, you know, in supporting, establishing, facilitating establishment of cooperatives, because the report by DTI included provinces for the first time. All along, we used to be given reports strictly and artificially on the work done by DTI. But when DTI started working with other, with the nine provinces, then we are able to get a better picture. Sorry, my question is loaded, but that's the reference, because I do not think we'll be able to have a sense if we only just say the NCT gives us, unless they work in a different way. But I'm just provoking. It's really about the coordination with the offices they're driven or run by provincial governments. Chair, also the use of shared services linked to the cost-benefit analysis that was asked by Honorable Smala. To me, the approach is that in order to ensure that NCT keeps the running costs as low as possible, have they considered the option of shared services with the other agencies? I must comment on this. I'm rather uneasy about that. There have been no referrals from the NCR, the National Credit Regulator. The National Credit Regulator has frequented on us. We've appreciated the good work they have done. They've actually, ruffled feathers. They've ensured that a lot of, support for the poor and the vulnerable in particular have do get support when they get bad services. But if there's been very little or at times maybe no referral, maybe it's not for NCT to answer that, but I would like to just make a comment. Maybe you should keep in mind when we interact with the NCR on that. The last step is the stakeholders conference. If the representatives can just share with us, just very briefly, in that charter conference, who were the stakeholders invited? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. September, Honorable September.
Thank you so much, Chair, and also thank you from my side for the presentation. I want to ask the following, Chairperson. Notwithstanding the mandate of yourself, one of the things that I'm quite intrigued that you are mentioning is the fact that we have experienced and probably continue to experience the economic meltdown, the international economic meltdown, and then, of course, the effect that it's had on your organization. And you also mentioned in your report that you had a really huge amount of effects of it, as you are saying in your report, flood of repossessions and so on. So I'd really like to know, in that regard, notwithstanding your mandate, you of course can't insulate yourself from it, but have to respond one way or another in whichever manner I am interested. To this reality. I heard this morning on the news that the current figures shows that we have more job losses. It's now not just this million of a loss, and it's added to it also. And then and notwithstanding those that are in jobs are poorer also. So how are you dealing with this phenomenon? Because I would imagine you can't just be a passive recipient. There must be some answers given to how do you fit into the bigger picture of everything. So I'm really interested to know, because, you can regulate poverty to only some extent. There are some other actions that needs to be taken in this regard. Having said that, then I'd like to know, I also want to associate myself with the questions on how do you market yourself? Because those that are jobless and those that are fearing they're going to be jobless and so on, and all the other things that go with it, and those that are in employment and who face similar problems, how do they get to you? How do they know where you are? How do you market yourself? Do you get to a little local
People's Post newspaper? Do you ever get to things like that? Or are you in the very mainstream of things? So I also want to know, how do you deal with that situation? Then I am keen to you made a quick reference to the fact that you are a small organization, and if I mentioned the wrong word that you used, just forgive me, but I think it means the following, and you said in the burden of having to comply with the PFMA also. What is your suggestion in this regard? Because you're not a private institution, you're part of the state, and therefore the PFMA, small or big, must comply. What is the burden that you are referring to? Tribunals, Chairperson, by its very nature, I've seen in other sectors, they out there in a little corner, no one sees, bothers with them. They've got an acting judge who's got other work to do, who cases pile up and so on. Are there lessons from the other tribunals that you are learning and can learn or not repeat? On the finances, Chair, you are saying in your report that one of the challenges, I didn't see you mentioning this one on your slide, but it's in here, is the fact that your remuneration of your members of the tribunal has not been adjusted since 2006. Is that still the case? If so, why? Then I think you probably did explain this other one, but your on your financial and your performance management, just explain this one that the Auditor General says, is that the information system used for generating performance information was not appropriate to facilitate the preparation of accurate performance information. I'm not sure if it was what you have explained earlier on. If that is the case, then of course you don't need to repeat it again. For now, Chair, let me leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, members. There is well over 20 questions to be dealt with. I leave it to you to decide how you want to answer, whether you want to group the questions according to how they are related to one another, or you just want to follow the list as it is. Over to yourself.
Chair, thank you, and thank you, members, for your question. The way we'll proceed is we'll go question by question and respond to it, and both my chairperson and myself will input and provide greater clarity on this in our response. The first question is around then the getting our information through to informal settlements and rural areas and whether people will really know about the tribunal. Dan, do you want to touch on this? Maybe I can end.
The sad reality for us is that the answer to that question is no. And that is the reality that we face as a tribunal, and I think with many agencies in South Africa today providing redress to consumers. And it is the difficulty as a tribunal being an adjudicative entity in essence, being able to reach out and then also fulfill that function. Now, we have spoken, there was a question around the National Credit Regulator being a frontline agency and the tribunal not that much of a frontline agency, and that is quite correct. And what we have done, so have had discussions with the National Credit Regulator to also include information about the tribunal when they go out with their information campaigns. And we do believe that they do put out information on the tribunal whenever they go out on the information campaigns. Linking to that question is the question about rural and urban outreach, and Honorable Njikalana was talking about the website and it's not been available. Now, we have learned a very interesting question about this. We, myself and Hazel, and you will do note that from our appearance, we are not probably that okay with cultural aspects in the deep rural areas as some of our other fellow South Africans would be. So we thought we are going out to a rural area and we're going to set up a workshop, we're going to put together a PowerPoint presentation, we're going to put out our information there in English, and we will have a workshop and we will say so many people attended and so on. That's not the reality. What we quickly realized is it is not us who can do that type of outreach. What we then did is we enlisted the assistance of the NGO who worked in those rural areas, who then got the chiefs together around the table, enlisted the chiefs to get their people to come to the presentation, got their buy-in about how we now going to proceed with this initiative so that we can really get the information to the people. What that made us realize, you know, we have the theories about how we're going to tell people all these wonderful things, but if in the practice and in the implementation it is not geared and targeted to those specific groupings, they basically amount to naught. So through that intervention, I believe that we've actually reached more through realizing that there are and has to be different ways of reaching out to these different communities, particularly in the deep rural areas. It took me 40 years to learn English. I've not had the 40 years yet for Zulu or Xhosa or Tswana or so on. So it's also the recognition around the question of language, that the issue of language is it is a barrier. And if you don't give people access to the information in the language that they're familiar with and understand, it also becomes pretty pointless. It is still a challenge for us how we will deal with languages, particularly in our outreach to communities. How we deal with it in our adjudication is much, much easier. Because when we send out, for example, a notice of sit-down for our hearing, we also say in our sit-down that you have a right to an interpreter and a translator. And that interpreter and translator is provided at the tribunal's expense. As long as we know that you have that need for that assistance at the hearing, we provide that assistance. So in that way, we address the issues around language in the tribunal. We only use one language. It is English right now. It is also about asking ourselves going forward how we're going to deal with other languages within the tribunal, in our website, in our communications, in our publications. We've not yet come to a conclusion about how we'll go about it and what is the cost implications of that be. The Honourable Member, September, you were talking about how do we market ourselves. Like I said, the tribunal, the strategy we have followed with marketing ourselves is to talk and make ourselves very well known to the provincial consumer affairs officers. The provincial consumer affairs officers work with consumer NGOs and entities within the provinces. And the arrangement we have with them is we make them aware of what we do, and when they go out into the regions, in the specific provinces, they then take our information forward. There was a question around the big picture. How do you see the big picture around the National Consumer Tribunal and the Provincial Consumer Affairs Offices and so on? The constitution of the country provides for concurrent jurisdiction. The consumer protection legislation, both the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act, gives the responsibility for providing redress both to the National Consumer Tribunal, the consumer affairs courts in the provinces, to the National Credit Regulator, as well as the National Consumer Commission. And how these roles basically interface, I think there's still going to have to be a whole lot of work, both nationally and provincially, around alignment of national consumer protection legislation, i.e. the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act, and the provincial consumer protection legislation through the Harmful Business Practices Act. And in terms of the legislation, that is an interaction that happens between the Minister of Trade and Industry and the members of the executive committees in the provinces. So that interaction, I'm sure the DTI, the minister, or the relevant officials could probably speak to that process, as well as the process of the alignment of the legislation. From the tribunal point of view, in terms of saying that there has to be regions to South Africans that are accessible, we are a small entity, we are located in Centurion. It is not possible to think that we can ever provide that level of access that is envisaged in this legislation only through the National Consumer Tribunal. So it has to happen hand in hand with the consumer protection agencies in the provinces. Hence, we are driving the mandate also in terms of the legislation that says that consumer protection legislation must be consistently applied across the country. That means through ourselves, the regulators, and the consumer affairs officers. So we work together around those types of issues. I just want to see if there's...
you've touched on that point. Maybe I can clarify the question that related to the provincial office. So how does it fit in? The tribunal doesn't have a provincial office. So we one office. We're based in Centurion. We named the National Consumer Tribunal. When I made reference to the provincial offices, I was talking about the provincial consumer affairs offices. And those provincial consumer affairs offices also have, some of them have consumer courts or consumer tribunals as they refer to them. So what we've been doing is having these capacity building initiatives, because the Act talks about concurrent jurisdiction with the provinces as well, is having those sessions with the provincial offices, but they're not our offices. It's really about working together with them and building that capacity. So the second question that related to the skills development around that and how many people attended is, when we have the capacity building workshop, it's the tribunal members that attend that workshop and the staff. So we're looking at around 20 people internally. And then we invite the provincial consumer affairs offices. And sometimes there's about 5 staff in the consumer affairs office, and if they've got a tribunal, then they bring about 4 or 5 court members. So just to clarify that issue around the provinces, we don't have provincial offices, but we work closely with the consumer affairs offices. Also around the issue Diane discussed about, you know, going out to the communities and really expressing our role and function. As a tribunal, we also need to manage the expectations. In terms of the Act and cases that can be brought to us, consumers can come to us under very limited circumstances. So a consumer can file an application if there's a review of the sale of goods that relates to whether their vehicle or the possession has been sold at the best price possible or as soon as possible. And then a consumer can file an application, come to us directly, if there's a dispute, if they want a statement from their credit provider. The credit provider is not providing them a statement, they can file an application. And if there's a disputed entry on the statement, they must still have the discussion with the credit provider. If they can't resolve it, then they can come to us. So you see, it's about managing the expectations. Out of about 32 different types of matters that can be filed with us, there's very few where a consumer can come directly to us. So when we do our education initiatives, or rather, initiatives around the role and function, it's also about managing the expectations. From experience, for example, we went into a rural area in Bloemfontein, and we had this presentation set up, myself, and at that point we had the full-time tribunal member, around all the roles and functions of the tribunal. And you know what we found is that we had to leave that presentation, because people wanted to talk about what are their needs, what are they experiencing, and how can we help them. And that's where we found this disjuncture, is when you go out to people, and as you indicated, Honourable Member, that we should look at these initiatives with the regulator, because people want to hear, what are my rights? How are you going to help me? And unfortunately, as a tribunal, they can't come to us with their complaints. They have to go to the regulator. And the regulators need to consider their complaints, be it jointly or as a group, and this is where you talk about, you know, redress to others. once the regulator does investigations, they will see, okay, there's more people impacted by this matter. And then the regulator would bring, if once they've investigated, they would bring a matter to us. So you can understand the people's frustration when you're sitting there and trying to tell them, this is what we do, and we adjudicate, and we're using all these high words. It doesn't help them. So it's really about managing that expectation. So when we talk about our role and function, it's about saying, as a tribunal, this is what we offer. But yes, I take the point. We need to look at initiatives with the frontline agencies and then say, and give the bigger picture in terms of, yes, how do we fit in as a tribunal? And then this is the assistance we can give you as a tribunal. And I think that will be more fruitful to people. Otherwise, we're really going to frustrate them in that process. So I just want to touch also, you know, when we talk about communication, what is that? One of the questions also dealt with, what are the procedures of bringing a case to the tribunal? Now, as I explained, there's limited cases where a consumer can come to the tribunal. Then we get applications from debt counselors, from credit providers, your credit bureaus, the regulators. So there's all these different types of applications. So if a consumer has to bring a case to us, they need to identify what is that case, and they have to fill out a form, and the fees are usually 100 rand or 50 rand. But, you know, as I said, the administrative burden to administer that fee when people are already in financial distress doesn't make sense. So one of the issues around the amendment would be to say, you know, we actually would just indicate that there shouldn't be a fee. We want to be accessible, so that fee should actually be eliminated. I indicated the rules do make procedure for the chairperson if a consumer applies to have that fee waived, and we have done that. We've had a case where the chairperson agreed to waive the fee, so the consumer didn't pay that fee. But that is the process then on how somebody would come forward. They would fill out a form, they would pay a fee, and they would give us all the documentation for a specific case. That's how they would file with us.
To come to the questions around when somebody comes to the tribunal and gets a positive outcome of the case, consent order application, where we find that consumers who come to the tribunal.
Excuse me, just a refresher, what's a consent order?
Sorry.
Okay.
My apologies. The legislation provides for consumers to have their debt rearranged, enter into an agreement with credit providers. Basically arrange for a lower repayment amount, probably mainly over a longer term. Or sometimes they'll even give, like the bond providers, like the banks would, for example, say, we'll give you a payment holiday on your bond, and then you take that bond amount that you would have paid for the bond, we extend your bond by 2 or 3 years, but then you take that amount that you would have paid for your bond and you settle your shorter term debt. And in that way, they manage to rearrange their debts, and they're actually able to become in a cash basis to be able to get out of their debt ultimately. So what happens is we then see debt counselors bring these applications on behalf of consumers. The most concerning thing that we have identified out of consent order agreements, which is why I want to talk to the issue of redress, is that consumers would have been overcharged on interest rates. Then they get into trouble. Then they come with the debt rearrangement agreement. In the debt rearrangement agreement, the interest rate is reduced to the legal limit. Because the approach and the position the tribunal has taken is, we will not endorse an agreement that is illegal and which is contrary to the legislation. Now, this is a serious problem. Those are only the consent orders who come to the, that come to the tribunal. So how many people out there are being charged interest rates that are illegal and as a result of their getting to debt, but do not get an opportunity to get that fixed through a consent order process? That is a big concern to us. When we get that type of matters, we routinely refuse to endorse that agreement because it's illegal. The credit provider shouldn't charge people interest more than what is legally allowed. And it's also a matter that is prosecutable in terms of the legislation because it's a prohibited practice. That is the one thing. The second thing that we have found with these debt rearrangement agreements is that, for example, somebody has free reserves of about $1,200 to repay their debt, and they agree to pay $1,500. And our question is routinely, how can you tie and bind a person to a court order that commits them to pay monies that they clearly do not have? Because that doesn't help anybody, because in a month they will pay, because they will beg, borrow, and steal. The second, third month they can't pay. Now, the impact of not meeting a consent order that's issued by the tribunal, it exposes them to contempt of a tribunal order. Non-adherence to a tribunal order means that you can be criminally prosecuted. So we have taken the stance that we won't allow it, and where we see that consumers have been overcharged on credit through these things, those are the types of matters that we would routinely refer to the regulator for investigation. And there are entities that we have also pointed out to the regulator where we see that they may be doing it as a matter of course. Then the second type of thing is in terms of the legislation in providing redress, when we get these cases coming to the tribunal, like the matter the CEO referred to, Mapeka, for example, we saw, you know, there's been huge write-ups in the press around these so-called voluntary surrenders. There's no such thing as a voluntary surrender. The legislation requires of a credit provider, when somebody is in default with their repayments, to follow a certain procedure in terms of the legislation to enforce the repayment of the debt. And if they don't do it, that's an illegality and it's a prohibited conduct. When we see that type of matter too, we also provide that to the regulator. So in our way, in the cases that come before us, we can also identify this type of illegalities that happens in the market, refer to the regulator. They can investigate and then refer it back to the tribunal for adjudication if necessary. So that is how we, in our way, also try and ensure that what we see indirectly, we can also ensure that people ultimately get redress. In terms of the Ombudsman and the courts and the National Consumer Tribunal and the interaction, the structure that's provided for both in the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act allows for an alternate dispute resolution process. Those alternate dispute resolution institutions are, for example, your Ombudsman, as well as the provincial consumer affairs offices can also fulfill an alternate dispute resolution process. It's only when a resolution of a matter fails at that level that it then gets escalated to the tribunal. The courts, in terms of the Constitution, in terms of the rights of access to justice, anybody can always go to the court, irrespective in terms of this legislation. They don't have to come to the tribunal. It's an option they exercise. But what would mitigate for them to come to the tribunal rather than the court is because they can have their cases prosecuted through the regulators at no cost.
And because of the legislation imposing a responsibility on us to be quick and fair and inquisitorial, it makes it easier for them to come to the tribunal. Just a word on the issue of inquisitorial quickly. Just basically mean that somebody comes, they don't have a lawyer. I don't expect, as a tribunal, we don't expect somebody to say to us that this problem that I have is linked to section 15J, small letter, Roman I, small AA. As a tribunal, we should look at the facts that comes before us, and we should be able to say, this is the issues in terms of the legislation, and interrogate the case on that basis. And basically lead the unrepresented parties through the process of the tribunal. And we get many, many unrepresented parties, particularly where the regulators investigated and the regulator decided to not refer. We frequently get cases where the consumers then privately refer the cases to the tribunal in terms of this legislation. So that type of provision is then of great assistance to them. Just to come to the Consumer Protection Act and the benefits of 1 April 2011 and whether it can be cast back to our current situation. Currently, we only hear cases under the National Credit Act, but there are already provisions of the Consumer Protection Act that people would be able to lodge claims with the regulator and the commission on 1 April, from 1 April of this year. Those specific actions relate to the strict liability for safe products. So if anybody has already bought goods in this year, they would be able to go to the regulator and come to the tribunal if the regulator decides not to prosecute, or through the regulator, and they'd be able to lodge claims for damages based on that, for prohibited conduct based on those specific sections of the legislation. The other provisions of the legislation, it's quite a complex time frames and the implementation is very complex, and it takes one time to actually sit and go through it and understand it. But on the product safety, product liability, that one definitely, 1 April this year, come 1 April next year, you'd be able to sue for that. I'm just looking if there's other questions relating to that. Honorable September, when you spoke about the looking and positioning us within the South African economic context, and you were talking about fewer people employed and more job losses, and people having less to do more with, that is the type of thing that drives the case numbers before the tribunal. Because that is the type of thing where people then start seeing that I'm now in financial distress and I need some assistance to get out of financial distress. And how we see it in two ways. We see it in consent order applications, and we see it in interim relief applications, your urgent interdict applications. Interdicts that people come to us and ask us, please stop the bank from selling my car on an auction. That's the type of thing that we see coming out of this. What we are doing is we are looking at some research just to give us a clearer idea of what would be those indicators that would drive our case numbers, but we don't have that available yet. We're hoping to have that in this year. So we're hoping that will help us to plan and manage the cases better that comes before the tribunal.
Sorry, Ms. Honorable September wants an immediate follow-up on your response.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the response. What I wanted to find out, there's obviously just a limit within which you can do certain things. Are you able to link up with the relevant group in the department or outside of the department to at least affair them with the trend in which we see certain things, because some of them, some of the economic problems need to be remedied some way. If it's not yourself, you deal with certain things only.
I can also just touch on this. We report to the Department of Trade and Industry quarterly, and there's also discussions that we have with them. We always look to see what is happening out there in the economy. What are the factors in terms of cases that are coming through to us or inquiries that people are making, and what is that bigger impact? So that information that gets communicated on a quarterly basis via our quarterly reporting and in discussions that we have with the DCI.
I just wanted to talk to one more issue, you know, and I know this is probably something that would come closer to the end. The question is, the lessons we have learned, and somebody said tribunal chairpersons, I'm sorry, honorable, one of the honorable members referred to tribunal chairpersons sitting somewhere in the corner and just gathering dust. You know what we have learned, and I just had a discussion also yesterday with lawyers here in Cape Town, is it is important that people know what are the cases before the tribunal so that they can intervene and they can put their specific issues also forward so that there can be a determination on it. So in the event of them wishing them to bring some form of damages action at a later point, that they know their issue has been determined, recorded, and there is a certificate that can be issued that enables them then to go to the High Court should they wish to claim damages. That is the one thing. But the other thing also is that it is very important that people actually get given assistance in any legal process, because it's such an intimidating and daunting process. It is very important that the tribunals take their roles and the inquisitorial responsibility very seriously. That is definitely something else we have learned. But also, the other thing that we have learned, and hence just to come back to the question about our stakeholder conference, being a consumer protection entity within the department, insisting that people do what is right and insisting that they meet certain obligations and so on, as a tribunal, we believe that we should also set the tone and set an example insofar as that is concerned. Hence, we had this discussion with particularly the parties who file with the tribunal, to say to them, what are your expectations? These are expectations. Also to promote a quicker turnaround on our cases so that the cases get finalized quickly. There's certainty much more quickly in terms of the cases that get filed before the tribunal. So those are basically the few interventions I'd like to make to the questions that have been asked.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to the questions around the consultancy fees and the tribunal considering them employing staff in this position. Yes, it is a consideration that definitely we need to implement, and we started implementing. Even in the putting together our strategic plan and our budget in this year, we consciously looked at consultancy fees and how do we cut down on them. So we've proposed the structure. You'll see it when you get our strategic plan, because I know it needs to be also tabled here, where you will see we're proposing to have more staff on board, and then that will reduce the consultancy fees. And in terms of the number of staff, we're looking at about 20 staff members. So currently the staff complement on the business case was 9. We're looking at a figure of 20. And that has to be approved, though, via the Department of Trade and Industry. So we've put it forward, and what we're looking at is having people on a contract until we get approval on the establishment. Linked to that is this issue about shared services, and it's something that, yes, we really need to consider. And we see this happening through, there have been discussions with the Department of Trade and Industry
that, remember, we're based in Centurion, that we join offices or share offices with the National Consumer Commission. And we're very keen to hold on that initiative, because that will mean we can share services like your IT. Because for now we have to get an outsourced service provider to do our IT for us. So we can look at ways of sharing a receptionist, for example. So that's definitely on the cards, and it's an initiative that we will take forward to ensure that we can cut down on the expenditure and use of consultants, and that we look at shared services. And as I said, the number of positions we would be about 20, and that includes the extended mandate of the consumer protection legislation. The question around the outstanding projects and whether we still have funds available for them, we have put in a request to retain our surplus funds, and these projects are still carrying on. So we're in the process of finalizing them. And one of the questions about the economic research is one of these projects that we're working on. The next question relates to the case statistics and the 250 cases that reflect as being incomplete. I'd really like to explain this process to you. When somebody comes and they bring a case to us, they need to make sure that they fill in the application. If there's a fee, they pay the fee. They give proof of service. They give us proof that they serve the document on the other parties. So there's specific things that they need to do when they bring an application. Now, the registrar's office has 3 days. When somebody comes with an application, whether you get one application today or 80 applications, as we've seen in a day, we've got 3 days to go through that case and get back to the parties and say, yes, your application is complete, and it goes to the next stage. Or your application is not complete, and we therefore require of you to give us, and we tell them in detail what is outstanding. Now, we can't take a case forward until the applicant has completed all those requirements. So unfortunately, what happens now on the case statistics is that it shows a high volume of cases that are incomplete. But we don't leave it as that. We then, at the tribunal, identified what are the reasons for those incomplete applications. So we do a trend analysis, and we say, okay, we're receiving 50% of the applications that are incomplete. What are the reasons, and what measures can we put in place to help the applicants to deal with it? So we thought a great deal for the consent order applications, that's the debt rearrangements, right? Where one of the requirements is that both parties, so the credit provider and the consumer, need to agree that this is the revised rate that they're going to pay. There has to be agreement on that, and that's one of the requirements. So we got a whole lot of consent order applications that came in, and they were all incomplete because the credit providers were just sending an email saying, yes, we agree to changing the rate, and you can pay 90 Rand now instead of 500 Rand. But there was no signed acceptance. So we then met with the debt council. We had a discussion with them. In the correspondence that we send to the parties, we then advise, and when we send correspondence, we send it to the applicant, to all the parties involved, so that we're transparent and everybody knows what is happening. And we said, if you still cannot get a signed acceptance from the credit providers, and a lot of them were in the banking industry, if you can't get that signed acceptance, then please file an application to deviate from the rules of procedure. So that then the tribunal, in considering that application, will subpoena the credit providers and say, why don't you want to sign this acceptance? And that we could then take the case forward. What we found from that initiative is very quickly we were getting credit providers now all of a sudden signing. Where they once said, oh, but an email will suffice, they then came back and they were signing the acceptances. So it's also about saying, you know, if you recognize these things, it's not about sitting back and saying, okay, the application is incomplete and we can't take it forward. It's also about saying, how do we help the parties to make sure that the application is complete so that the case then goes forward. But yes, we have those initiatives. Sometimes parties come back to us, sometimes they don't. They leave the case incomplete. The second initiative is we developed a guideline document that says, this is how you file an application, these are all the steps, and we tried to simplify that process. And that was also distributed to all our stakeholders. So that's then explains that figure of 250 cases. As I stated, if it's incomplete, the case cannot move forward. The issue of the small organization and the compliance burden, it's just to highlight that, yes, as a small entity, we have to meet the same requirements. And we make every effort to ensure that we comply. So it's not about us saying, no, we're small, so we won't comply. We make every effort to comply, but we do want to highlight that it does place a burden. For example, as I mentioned before, the PSMA says that you need to have a chief financial officer. Now, can you imagine the cost of an establishment of 9 posts to appoint a chief financial officer? It doesn't make sense for the organization. So that role, then I fulfill that function, but then we have to have segregation of duties. So all I'm saying is that we do comply. We put a lot of effort into good corporate governance, but we do recognize that it places a burden on us. Okay. Around the... of the compliance. The other compliance is all your policies and procedures, monitoring that you're complying with policies and procedures. You have to have that in place. So somebody's got to monitor that in the organization. Okay. I mean, we've got, 50 or 30? Or 30? Yeah, okay.
Being a tribunal of record, it's very important for us that we comply to the laws that we are required to comply with. So the process we have done is we have basically gone through all the laws in this country, and we have asked ourselves, as a public entity, and as an entity funded by taxpayers' money, what is it that we have to comply with? In doing that exercise, we have found that there's approximately 45 different pieces of legislation we have to comply with as a governance matter. And then in terms of now translating those specific requirements, many of them have to be translated into policies. Now, when you translate any of these pieces of legislation into a policy within the organization, you will find that typically one piece of legislation would have, for example, 10 to 15 compliance requirements. Now, when you put that in a policy, it means somebody actually has to ensure that that happens. So then how do we, with 9 people, ensure that we at all times comply with this legislation, comply with our mandate, do the things that we have to do? So it's about then saying, how do we put a system in place that we can track, first of all, what we need to do, and secondly, track that we do what we need to do, and thirdly, that we have the information that can support that we are doing what we need to do. That is on one level on the legislative area. Then in terms of the Treasury regulations, there's about 10 or 15 items, and I hope I'm correct, that we have to comply with on a monthly basis. Numerous things we need to do. On an annual basis, we have to do our in-year reporting, as you are aware, our end-of-the-year reporting, our management accounting. We have to track our funding for investments. We have to ensure that we also always have the counterparties are appropriate, that we've checked up on that. It's a whole host of things. So when you look at our budget that is allocated to us and you look at our cost of compliance in relation to the budget, it is very high. And that is the challenge. So with the smaller entities, you find that the percentage of your budget allocated to compliance is higher than for bigger entities because of a portion of the budget. But it is really, really a lot of things. With Kingsley now, with the ICT governance requirements, the HR governance requirements, the general governance requirements, treasury regulations, over and above the PFMA, all the other pieces of legislation, whether it's basic conditions of employment, any of the labor laws, any of those, it is really, really, pardon the terminology, it is really hectic. So that is where the difficulty comes in, just to keep up with that and ensure that that is done. It's not a problem for the tribunal. We don't see it as a problem because we appreciate that. So through that is accountability. And the fact of the matter is the tribunal is funded through taxpayers' money, and we have to account for that. So we don't have a problem. We just wanted to note that it is costly.
There were two other issues around the challenges that were raised. I did touch on the remuneration of the tribunal members. I addressed that challenge. Then on the performance information, not having adequate systems, that was raised by the Auditor General. I explained that to say we have put in a performance information policy from early as 2008-2009. We collect information. We're consistent in the manner in which we collect it. We verify the performance information. It came down to the issue of terminology and the way we interpreted issues around, for example, the 100% of cases adjudicated on and the way the AG has seen that. So that is where that comes from, that the performance information system is not reliable to collect information.
Honorable Smala, you want to make a follow-up on your question? You want to? Okay. Can we finish this and then you will allow?
Okay. I think we have covered all the questions. If there's anything we missed out, the members could, or they want further clarity, I'm sure we'll be willing to do that.
Thank you. Honorable Smala.
Yeah, I think the one that I've got that directly link is that they are.
Can you please use your mic?
The register is required to complete this assessment within 3 days, and you did express some concerns towards that and regulations that might have got to be amended to that. I just wanted to know in the process how far you are, and you know, will it be done in order, you know, in order to assess that. I was also wondering when you did set up your KPIs consistent that you would have a growth of say 10%, you know, from 26, and then you suddenly have got a growth of excess of 1,000 or whatever. Are you not setting some of your targets maybe too low? Or will your research that you are envisioning now and determine your process here? And just on a curious note, did you deal at any stage maybe with the Sambo F&B cases that is, you know, that are being linked for interest, you know, for access of interest, this whole thing, or was it the National Credit Regulator that actually dealt with those cases? I was just wondering if they were actually passed on to you. Thank you.
It would have been the regulator, to come to your last question first, who would have dealt with that. Around the time frame, this is the dilemma. The thing is, the 3 days have been set in the rules so that people can know for sure that somebody will come back to you, and they won't just come back to you and say that I have received your document. It requires more than that. It requires a real assessment and a response to an application to say it's going forward or it's not going forward. Now, the difficulty is, and the registrar, and I'm referring to it as the registrar, and I have an ongoing debate about that. The registrar's view is extend the time frame. My difficulty is, yes, we can extend the time frame. Maybe DTI will agree, maybe they won't agree. But to what point do you extend time frame? Because you can say now you get 80 and then you get 150 cases. Is it about the time frames or is it about the resources and flexible resources to deal with it? You know, otherwise, what this legislation is promising to consumers won't eventuate, because we, the time frame of 3 days will become 5 days, will become 10 days, will become 15 days. And it's a never-ending thing, potentially. So really, it's asking the question, is that extending time frames, or is it about looking about flexible resourcing
that you can pull in to deal with areas times of high demand. Now, what we have already seen this year, now, of course, it's not relevant for this reporting period that this report relates to, but we have already received up to the end of this quarter, which is only the second quarter of this year, more than double the cases that we've received in the past 3 years. So that is a concern. So we also don't see the tribunal as this huge entity. It has to, in our view, and Parliament and the DTI will probably, the committee and DTI will debate these issues, I'm sure, but there is a concurrent jurisdiction with the provinces. So the question is, when will the provinces be ready to take on that responsibility? And when will their systems and processes be in place? Because if they're not getting in place, and quite quickly, you will have a situation where an entity that's intended to remain small will become huge because it has to then deal with the demand also from the provinces. So that is a big question for us. And we, from internally, my discussions with my little advisory committee, audit risk committee, with the CEO and registrar, is that really we shouldn't become a huge entity because it takes away from the stated intention of the legislation that consumer redress must be accessible, and it cannot be accessible through an entity that has one central office in Centurion. It has to work hand in hand with the provinces. So that is my view. So the registrar will share your view because she's the one who has to then say why she doesn't meet the 3 days.
Thank you. Well, you'll see from our report that we somehow we make sure that we meet those 3 days because it's about providing people with certainty. And, you know, if we are expected to get back to people within 3 days, then we make sure that we do that. Now, what we have put in place is we have moved, reshuffled internally. We moved one staff member into the registrar's office so that somebody can assist me with that evaluation. And where there's high demand, then we've been utilized. We've trained a panel of lawyers, and we've been looking at bringing them on board. Now, again, it comes to the issue of cost. Because on one hand, we don't want to increase the structure and have 40 people when you don't know what this influx could be. You saw the spend, 11 cases, 26,488. Already we're sitting at over 500 cases for the year, for this financial year. So it's about, yes, we can do the research, but still it may not give us those exact figures of what we can expect. Getting into the consumer protection legislation, it's a new field. We don't know what could come out of that. So on one hand, we can't also increase the structure and bring in all these resources on a permanent basis. On the second hand, we've been looking at, okay, at this moment we trained lawyers to make sure they can begin deal with the 3-day turnaround time. But then we've been looking at other initiatives, looking at getting assistance from law students who can help us. So if we cut down on actually having a consultancy fee, look at getting interns on board who can help us. So yes, we're thinking about looking at different avenues, but I think the bottom line is that we want to ensure that if you want to be accessible, if you want to be quick, we need to be able to stick then to those relatively shorter time frames. So people will know after 3 days, yes, my case is proceeding, no, it's not proceeding, and I need to do 1-2-3.
And particularly in the National Credit Act, these are distressed people. These are people who are in trouble. So they need a resolution. They don't need somebody saying to them, I'll come back to you in 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. They need certainty and they need to know where they're going. Under the Consumer Protection Act, hopefully and maybe we will have more flexibility, but we don't know. But lawyers are expensive, so we need to think of other solutions that might not have to include lawyers.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal. Thank you, CEO, for engaging with us. Can I suggest that we take a short break before we go on to our next item, perhaps 5-7 minutes? I imagine we can safely say we can release you from sitting in the meeting now. Thank you very much. Written budgetary review and recommendations report. Marco will quickly take us through that, and then we will look at the process of how we want to proceed with the budget review. Report. Now, Steph, just before she leads us, we didn't introduce ourselves earlier this morning. I assumed, because I know almost all the people I see here, but perhaps we can quickly do that. So that we get to know who we are.
Okay, I'm still honorable and I'm still the same.
Yes.
Honorable still and smaller.
No. Alright. Sitangoma Mabasa.
Now, Tuabaza, and next to me is the Secretary of Committee, Andre Herman.
I'm Zubele Ngwisho, the new Referrer for Trade and Industry Committee, for this committee specifically.
George Schneider, Parliamentary Officer, DTI.
Margaret Herning, Appointed Advisor for the committee.
Atul Patel from Ethical Consulting.
Okay. I wasn't quite aware that somebody not a member of the committee and probably not a member of parliament would be here. It would be interesting to know on what capacity you're coming in, so that we know who we're dealing with.
I'm here on behalf of the clients that we represent, including the Banking Association of South Africa. We were here to listen to the presentation of the Consumer Tribunal. The banks are obviously heavily affected by the work of the tribunal and the other consumer bodies that have been set up in the DTI.
No, thank you. You are welcome. We just wanted to know so that we certain we of who is here and in what capacity that person is here. But you are welcome. Thank you very much for your interest in the work of the Committee on Trade and Industry. Marco, go ahead.
Okay, I'll be presenting a presentation that was done by our finance cluster to other parliamentarians and other committees relating to the budgetary review and recommendation report and what's expected of us. Constitutionally, Parliament has the right to actually approve, amend, or reject a money bill. Previously, we've only been exercising the right to approve or reject, but this bill, amendment procedure and related matters act has not given us the power to actually also amend our money bills. Specifically relating to this area of BRRR is Section 5 of the Act. and this outlines what the committee's role is in developing BRRRs, but also in terms of the whole budgetary process. The main purpose of the BRRR is to assess the department's performance in terms of service delivery. So, Section 5 of the Act provides that the National Assembly through its committees must annually assess the performance of each national department, and committees must annually submit BRRRs for tabling in the National Assembly. A BRRR is to be submitted to the Finance Minister and the Cabinet Member of a vote. So the purpose of the BRRR is to assess in terms of managing and evaluating what the department has been doing for the year, given the available resources, as well as how have they effectively and efficiently done this. And then it also grants the committee an opportunity to recommend how they see, they can have the opportunity to recommend if they see other uses or more uses of the resources for the department. The next sections cover the content of the BRRR. The cover page in general obviously say who the committee is and the chairperson and which year it is. Then the contents of the BRRR will include an introduction as strategic priorities and objectives of the department, an analysis of the strategic and operational plans, an analysis of annual report and financial statements, and the consideration of scopus reports, consideration of other information or information sources, conclusion and recommendations. In the introduction, it will be the committee outlining what its mandate is in terms of BRRR and its methodology used to compile the BRRR. So, for instance, we would state that we've seen the department in terms of its annual report and any other entities, as well as if we've asked for other inputs from other stakeholders or experts in this regard. And then outlining the department's mandate in terms of its vision and mission. In terms of the strategic priorities and objectives, we'd be looking at a summary of what the strategic objectives or priorities for the year was, as well as the measurable objectives, so what the KPIs were for that year in terms of the stress plan. This would have also formed part of our own budget process at the beginning of the year, where we would have done an analysis of the budget in alignment with the strat plan. So that would be that analysis. So evaluating the strategic and operational plans against outcomes of the department, and also inviting other inputs and evidence related to this. Analysis of Section 32 reports relates primarily to looking at spending trends analyses. Every quarter, and I think also every quarter, the National Treasury, in alignment with the Public Finance Management Act, publishes reports on what the spending trends of the departments were for each vote. This would include spending on general consumption and operational issues, as well as capital and transfers. So we would then look at whether or not the spending patterns were under or over expenditure for each quarter, and we would look from for a period of 18 months. So that would include the annual reports of the previous year and then the last 6 months of this year, of the current financial year. Okay, and then we can also supplement this section with the Standing Committee on Appropriations reports on quarterly spending by certain departments. They would usually handpick certain departments that they've considered as having issues or needing attention, and if our department is falling under that category, we would then be able to substitute the information as well. Then in terms of analysis of annual reports and financial statements, every year these are normally tabled at the end of September. There has been a recommendation also that they should be tabled earlier so we can factor them in completely by the end of October to meet the new requirements. And now with the Brewer, instead of previous years we would have done a report on our annual report, now we will have that as part of the Brewer and not two separate reports any longer. So then they've just made a suggestion that the leader of government business encourages ministry to submit their documents earlier to meet our deadlines. And then SCOPA the Act provides that committees must consider SCOPA's reports and department's annual reports. As far as I know, SCOPA has been going through the process. I don't believe that our department has had a comment from them, but if we can just double check that. SCOPA would then verify the existence of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, irregular expenditure, overspending, and unauthorized expenditure, and reasons for this from the department. And we can also invite additional input from SCOPA as well as the AG in terms of those aspects. So the challenge is that not all annual reports may have been reported on by SCOPA for the process due to their workload, and which is possibly the case this year. And they've been advised to prioritize the departments rather than the public entities. And then other sources of information, during the year we also do, as a committee, do analysis of the State of the Nation address, which we can then also incorporate into our BRRR. Further information can be gained from reports of the National Planning Commission and the Ministry on Performance Monitoring and Evaluation in the Presidency, as well as the reports of the Auditor General. And then I don't think this is relevant to our specific committee recommendations of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. And then furthermore, other recommendations that we've made in our own fact-finding and oversight reports, as well as prior BRRR in future, and then our recommendations and findings from our own budget votes, determining whether those have actually been taken into account, and whether they've been efficiently dealt with, or if there's still gaps. So then the report should contain the committee's observations in terms of our key findings, based on the analysis of all the reports and the work we've done throughout over the last 18 months as well. Our conclusion should obviously be based on our observations and focusing on the achievement of strategic priorities and objectives of the department and the efficient, effective, and economical use of both monetary and non-monetary resources. So also the HR requirements and other IT and those type of issues. And then we need to make a clear statement whether we are satisfied with how the department has been delivering its service and whether or not additional funding is required. It's an option that we do have at this stage. In terms of our recommendations, they've outlined just the requirements for which we need to meet in drafting recommendations. This would include that it must conform to the Constitution, adhere to the principle of separation of powers and the principle of cooperative governance. And then finally, our recommendations must be clear, so we need to be determined who we need to do fulfill that recommendation and how. It's got to be practical, so it's got to be something that is doable within a certain period of time. And then we need to just also state what those time frames are.
Thank you, Marco. Members, I want to suggest that we look at the process of dealing with this and not necessarily discuss this document as it is, unless somebody wants to add or clarify something that is not clear in the document for our purpose, for the purposes of this particular committee. Does anyone want to seek clarity or add something? No? Okay. Let's look at the process. I think the document does guide us on how we should do that. If I were to summarize what I understand as has been presented, what we need to do is to look at the annual reports of the department and its entities, and look at and analyze and evaluate the performance of the department and its entities against and evaluate that performance against their strategic plans, and see whether they have performed according to their strategic plans. Secondly, look at their spending and see whether their spending talks to the strategic objectives of the department and its entities. That's the third area. And of course, informed also by the reports of SCOPA on the department and its entities. And the document further says that SCOPA may not necessarily have looked at all the entities of the department, for instance. So that exercise would be upon the committee to complete that, to look at the entities and make an opinion as well. Fourthly, we are required to make recommendations based on the analysis and the evaluation of the performance of the department and its entities, based on whether they are spending patterns are addressing the strategic objectives that they have set for themselves. But I think also more importantly, we have to look at, for instance, the key questions that we will have to look at as well, or we'll have to be guided by to see if the departments are addressing issues, for instance, of job creation, BEE, and cooperatives, to see if their spending addresses the question of broadly that and perhaps other issues that are related to that. So I think basically what we need to do are those five process steps, and then make recommendations. I understand also that when we make these recommendations, we are not just simply making recommendations to the department, but also the Act itself allows us to influence Treasury as well. If we think there is something that Treasury has got to do, for instance, in terms of increasing funding for the department or a particular entity which we think has not been funded enough to fulfill its objectives. So let me leave it at that and see whether we agree on the process that we need to follow. So that when we, for instance, we met the National Consumer Tribunal today, next week we are meeting the others together with the department. And at the end of that process, we will have had an idea of what the department's performance is together with entities, and then we'll be in the position to then make recommendations.
Yes,
Honorable Sala.
Look, I think the procedures are right the way that you put them forward, but it also should be clear that I don't know if you'll be able to analyze all the reports of the various entities that falls under this committee. And that should be also be clear because of our time frame and our work schedule, that some of these reports we will also have to prioritize certain reports to others.
Honorable September.
Chair, thank you. I'm first of all interested in our own readiness for this. And that is, for example, we had these people before us this morning, the tribunal before us this morning. Now, if we just take the example of them and juxtapose it against all of these things that have just been said, then I'm afraid to say we've missed the first test, because I would imagine we should gauge the entities in the same manner that we would be doing with the department. That's the first concern, Chair, that I have, our own readiness, and maybe we should speak about how do we make sure that we could be ready ourselves. The second thing that I want to say is, let me just request for those of us that joined later, if things like the budget that you dealt with earlier in the year, and maybe last year also, could be given to some of us that were not here, those documentation. Chair, the other thing is this, we're going to be dealing with the MTBPS today. It's not mentioned in all of it. It's extremely relevant because it's also forward-looking, and somehow that needs to be factored in also. I do want to submit, Chair, that, the cycle that the departments work is not the same as Parliament. So, for example, the MTBPS is tabled today, and that means they have a sense of the divisions that are being set out for the next 3 years. Where do we get into all of this? What do we want to tailor? What do we want to change? And so on. So I think, Chair, it will help even, it should be appreciated that give us that information also, so that the input that we make would be meaningful and would be able to influence in such a way. departments have done their BID committee stuff already in meeting with treasuries and so on. Our one will come as a bit of an afterthought. The proposals that we will be making, I mean, by when would we want those proposals to be? Because I come back to the MTBPS again that says in the next 3 years, these are the things that we will want to have. Do we want to place the emphasis into the next MTBPS process, which in any event is the key one more than the budget that we receive at the beginning of the year? How do we then influence that reality? A lot of people think that when we listen to the Minister of Finance in February, it's the main thing. The main thing is not that. The main thing is today. On February, we just hear whatever else. So, Chair, I think it is quite a lot of those kind of factors that we need to build into this entire process. The truth is, what is our readiness and how are we going to ensure our own readiness for this process? If it's not too perfect this year, then we should maybe not be too hard on ourselves, but maybe we should, so that we get it right the next time. Having changed the legislation deriving out of the Constitution is a major thing for empowerment of the legislature, for Parliament. And so I think we should not be found wanting in taking up this challenge that we have fought for 15 years. Long time. We have it now.
I think we need to acknowledge that the timing of this BRRR, at least this year, is not to our favor. And I think this document does make reference to that, I think, on page 12. And there's a suggestion that perhaps the process should begin somewhere in August. But I think, and of course, between now and the end of this session, I agree with you, there isn't much time. But perhaps let's look at what we can do, notwithstanding the fact that already today, the Minister of Finance is addressing us on the same issues, and we will not have been able to input into what he's going to be saying. And it's not this committee alone; I think all the other committees have a similar problem. Andre, you wanted to say something, and Honourable Njikelani.
Just in terms of the process, I think the parliamentary program prior to, indicated that the committees would have dealt with the BRRR process on our return immediately up till just before, and committees will then also then. I don't think the idea is that the committee will influence what the minister will say today, but going forward, finally, when the Standing Committee on Population report is tabled and debated by the House, when the committees will feed into that. Originally, our committee scheduled this BRRR process for the 12th of October, but due to certain requests made by the department, the minister wasn't able to, I think the 14th of October, wasn't able to be present at the time. So Parliament has made provision, or two-week process provision, for committees to consider the BRRR report process. We just request that because of the other request that it will be obviously not, we won't be able to comply with the time that Parliament has set aside for committees to deal with that, because our minister would be in prison during our if we consider the annual report of the department. But Parliament has made provision for that process, and many committees has completed that process. But also there's many challenges just in the section in terms of what members have raised in terms of the process and how we deal with it. There are many challenges. I think going forward we probably would address those challenges as committees and as a parliament.
clarify the MTBPS point that I've raised. I'm not talking about today, the MTBPS in general is the main adjustment one. So it's not that we missed the boat for now, it's just to bear in mind that the MTBPS has got a particular a role, and I mean, I hear what the secretary is saying. Next year, let's just see, because I think we also can't, you know, if minister's not available and so on. We have a legislative obligation, by the way, now.
Yeah.
And it's looking at ourselves, it's not looking at anyone else.
Thank you, Chair. Well, first of all, I just would like to give my few inputs to say, yes, I do appreciate the brief budget review and recommendation report. But to quite an extent, maybe I need to give myself time. I'd like to see what exactly is new about this, because as far as I can argue, it's nothing new. If you look at what was presented before, I remember there was a document that was presented by the, or that was developed by the National Treasury a couple of years ago around exercising oversight, particularly on reports and financial reports in particular, both performance and financial reports. And one of the things I remember that was highlighted there that reports must be submitted something like a minimum of 2 months before they are considered, so that committees can apply their minds, you know, scrutinize them and all sorts of things. I'm sure some of us would remember that document. In the last term, I remember I did even have a copy on that. And this links to the fundamental of preparedness in order for us to exercise our constitutional obligation of, conducting oversight on the performance of the department. Amongst other things, is that I look with great admiration in any case that here reference is made to the fact that we should expect reports from the National Planning Commission and the Ministry in the Presidency that do performance monitoring and evaluation. I'm sure whether those reports are available or not, but it's also an interesting area that would, you know, reinforce and strengthen our hand in doing our work. But all I'm saying, Chair, is that obviously I concur with my colleagues that we've missed the boat this year, and we should prepare ourselves ahead of time, and we should be proactive in future and not even wait for this process, but probably 3 months or whatever, 2 months before, start giving signals that we expect, reports or even plans to be submitted in time so that we can scrutinize them. There is a lot of expectation and growing expectations within our people that we should not just do our job, but also improve and do better than yesterday. Last two things, Chair, is that I hope somewhere, somehow, there would be a fraud and corruption barometer, because it's one of the highlights that takes place and that is expected this year. There is not a single political party in this parliament that has not committed itself to ensure that we join hands and stamp out fraud and corruption. Whilst, of course, the reports are not about fraud and corruption, but it should be appropriately highlighted. The reason why I highlight the term barometer, we should be able to also, assess the extent to which fraud and corruptive activities within the department are being addressed, are being stamped out, and the extent to which they are also negatively affecting the operations and the performance of the department. And I hope at some stage there will be some re-empowerment, even if
we did get it earlier, about the whole cycle, as Honorable September has indicated. You know, there's planning, there's budgeting, and on both there are reports in the form of an annual report, in the form of a financial report. And in between, there's monitoring and evaluation that we do through oversight in all forms. And, Chair, that generates a lot of information. And at some stage, you need to be quite creative as how to make sure that in our own single brains, we're able to keep that and be able to, at the stage where we do our balance sheet regularly around this time of the year, we're all able to bring all that information and to be able to do the appropriate assessment. And I trust down the line we'll be able to ensure that, you know, we have a good mechanism that is able to bring and funnel all the information into one platform and are able to, as I say, you know, conduct appropriate oversight and assessment of the work that has been done by the department. And particularly the reference I would make there, Chair, is the fact that in spite of some of the agencies within DTI being shifted to the new Department of Economic Development, we still have quite a large number. I don't know, we've gone down to around how much now, 15? I don't know. Somewhere there, I may not be accurate, but there's still quite a lot. And I mean, ideally, we're expected to handle all of them as to where and how we do that. Those are the things that I appeal very formally to, that between now and the next round, next year, 2011, we should prepare ourselves on that. But Chair, all my saying that, sort of all the long talk I've done, is that let us condition and tell ourselves that to quite an extent, this is just reaffirmation and reinforcement of what we should have been doing in the past, and let's make sure that when we start doing it, we do with the necessary vigor and commitment. Thanks, sir.
Okay. I'm tempted to ask this question. Where do we stand now, as it is? What do we do next? Do we start the process? And not necessarily with the view of making any impact this time around, given the limitations we've just observed. Honorable September.
Chair, if you follow what Honorable Njikalana is saying, then there's a chance that you would have done in any event, whether there's this BRRR or not. So I think that part we obviously can't discard. So the question is our readiness with regards to that. So both from all three the different staff members that we have here, we can look at this thing and ask probably by when would we be getting some of these things. The annual report is out already. The department has complied. The other entities, I would imagine, they all have complied. The annual reports are here. It is up to us now to find out how soon we can get the information to answer the questions that the legislation is asking us to do. So one, the research analysis of these things, the cross-checking with the threat plan and the AR of everyone else, and then all the other additional information that are being asked here. The one that might get away this year is the fact that the ministers have signed performance agreements only recently. So I'm not sure. I also don't want to put my head on the block to say that they might get away. Maybe there are reports from planning and, you know, all of those other people already. So Chair, I'm saying that the ones that we would have done any event Where is that? I also, does this committee have a little subcommittee that deal with this?
Yes, Honorable September, I think you're making a proposal that we look at the subcommittee to start looking at what we should do in any case. That's one. But two, the researcher as well. The researcher as well would suggest he should do some work on that. But perhaps let's test the view that says let's have a small committee which looks at the reports that we have that we were supposed to deal with anyway and prepare a report to the committee and probably a report with recommendation. Can we go that route? I suppose it's agreed. Can we then look at the members, the small team that can look into that, including the researcher? Proposed name?
I just also wanted to say that there was also a task team established also from this committee that also deals with, you know, there's also a smaller committee, the actual task team, that dealt with the
IP?
Which was also, I think, only 4 members or something. I'm not sure how big that task team is. We could utilize the same members of that task team. I don't know. It's a proposal.
He wants to go the Sir General's route.
Just how much that committee is still loaded with that kind of work. So I'm a bit. I wouldn't want us to probably go that route. Perhaps let's look at another team because that process is itself not complete yet. And I know that team still has to complete its work and make a submission to the committee. Honorable Mabaso.
I propose, Committee Chair, that
Honorable Mabaso.
I propose, Committee Chair, that yourself and Comrade September constitute the subcommittee and that you head it, and then from there we must then get a name. No, we don't have to go far. It means you are proposed so that then we then have thanks, Comrade.
Did I see your hand, Comrade?
I support the proposal.
Chair, well, we obviously don't need to propose the chair, but the chair would be part of it. The chair, Trump.
Oh, yes.
The chair of the day.
Yes. Okay. I am being alerted to the fact that we don't have the quorum, so we may not take a decision on this matter. However, what we can do, I think, is go to the next meeting to formalize this proposal. Okay. We are agreeing. We are not taking a decision on that this task team is now constituted and must start working. We are saying we will take this proposal to the committee to be formalized by the committee, and then it will start running with the process. Agreed?
Okay.
Any other issue? There is an item, the last item was on the adoption of minutes, but I think given this situation, we are not even going to attempt to go there. Anything else? No? The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much.